Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with The Wall Street Journal, Julia Ongwin, who has uncovered a new government surveillance regime at the National Counterterrorism Center that was resisted by privacy rights officials in the Department of Homeland Security before being put in place last March by John Brennan, President Obama's nominee to head up the CIA. We will discuss this new program described as a sea change in the government's ability to collect data on its citizens. Julia has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Then we'll examine the brazen actions of the Virginia legislature, where Senate Republicans passed a radical redistricting plan while a key Democrat was attending the presidential inauguration. Keisha Gaskins, a voting rights advocate and senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program, joins us to discuss the latest gerrymandering in a key swing state and whether the Republicans, who are on the losing end of changing demographics, plan to stay competitive by rigging the vote. Then finally, we'll be joined by Joel Castex, who is a spokesperson for SNAP, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests. She will address the just-released records the Archdiocese of Los Angeles have fought for years to keep secret that reveal Cardinal Roger Mahoney hid sex abuse cases from authorities. We will discuss the now-retired Cardinal's contrition in the face of more and continuing evidence of a systemic cover-up of abuse by pedophile priests in the Catholic Church. And joining us now is Julia Ongwin, who is an award-winning investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at The Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. And in 2010, she led a team of reporters that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know that won the Gerald Loeb Award. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julia Ongwin.
Happy to be here.
And through the Wall Street Journal, you've gotten freedom of information requests and interviews with a number of senior officials. And let's go back to that meeting in the White House Situation Room last March. I guess it was chaired by John Brennan, the counterterrorism chief, who is now the nominee for the Central Intelligence Agency. What went on in that meeting?
So in that meeting, top officials from the intelligence agencies got together to discuss a new program they were putting together that would allow people in the U.S. to be surveilled even if they were not suspected of a crime, that their records, which were stored in government agencies, could be collected by the National Counterterrorism Center and analyzed for clues to see if they might be terrorists. And this was a big change because previously the intelligence community had operated under a code where if you're going to look at U.S. citizens and track them, you have to have a good reason to do so. And now they were deciding to switch the burden of proof, so now it was innocent people being, you know, who were being surveilled and actually having to prove that they were not terrorists.
So I take it that this new regime, in effect, according to one of the critics who resisted this change within the government, saying that the first thing the government will want to know about you is are you a terrorist?
Right. This woman, Mary Ellen Callahan, who was at the time the chief privacy officer at the Department of Homeland Security, was the one arguing in this meeting that this was going to be a sea change in the way the government interacts with the public. And the sea change she was talking about is that previously, if you had an interaction with the government, say you file your taxes or you go to a Veterans Administration hospital or whatever it is that you do that relates to the government, you don't have an expectation that you're being analyzed to see if that transaction you conducted with the government actually is a sign that you're a terrorist. And this program would actually change that equation so that you would sort of have to expect that you're being analyzed during those moments. And she was arguing that that was something that they should really be cautious about, because that really changes the whole relationship between citizens and the government.
So given that John Brennan was chairing this meeting without sort of inventing a dialogue, but trying to sort of put oneself in this meeting, I take it that what he's arguing is that the system failed at the time of the underwear bomber, who turned out he wasn't in the existing system that they had. That was Christmas Day of 2009. And apparently what the counterterrorism people in the government felt after that was that this was not a failure to collect or share intelligence. It was a failure to connect and integrate and understand the intelligence we had. That's actually quoting John Brennan.
Right. That was his quote at the press conference when, after the underwear bomber mishap, you know, where they hadn't characterized him correctly and hadn't put him on the watch list. The government did a sort of a self-examination, like what went wrong. And what went wrong in the underwear bomber case was that they actually had intelligence that he was a suspected terrorist, but he hadn't been placed on the watch list, mostly because of sort of, you know, just simple mistakes. So there were some people who, like, his name was misspelled maybe in some records or in some of the queries, and hadn't put all the pieces of data that were in various government repositories weren't pulled together into the National Counterterrorism Center's analysis the way that they should have. It's worth just pointing out, the National Counterterrorism Center is a new agency, was just created in 2004 for the sole purpose of connecting these types of dots.
Well, I recall, though, at the time of the underwear bomber, in the recriminations that followed, that the CIA was informed via the Nigerian embassy, I believe, that the underwear bomber's own father said that his son was dangerous.
Yes. So what happened was there was a lot of information in the various government locations that would have, should have led, right, for him to be put on the watch list, and that was a failure. Now, the question really that was being debated in the Situation Room was, what was the right way to address that failure? So the people who are arguing for this change were saying, look, you know, it was too hard for us to go to each agency and go to the CIA and say, look up everything you have about Abdul Muttalib, and maybe they ran the query wrong or they spelled it wrong or they didn't get the right data, and then go to another agency and say, give us everything you have on Abdul Muttalib. Because that's the traditional way that this type of connecting the dots works. You have to go to somebody and say, I have a suspect, give me everything you have about that suspect. They were saying, look, this method hasn't worked. What we need is all the data in-house, so we can have computers just run and match all this stuff very easily. You know, in their mind, it was really a technical issue. If all the data is there, then computers can do the matching. It eliminates the possibility of human error. And that all may be very true. But the people arguing against the change were saying, look, in fact, you knew he was a suspect. And so this wasn't a failure of our policies of only looking at data about people who are suspects. So no need to pull in every single person's data and make them sort of de facto a suspect if they're really innocent. And so this was a philosophical debate, and some of it is about technology. Is technology the solution here in the sense that maybe computers will do this matching better and no one will be harmed, or maybe computers are going to make us all into suspects?
Again, I'm speaking with Julia Angwin, who is an award-winning investigative journalist at the Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America, and she received the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on corporate corruption, and in 2010 led a team that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Now, so let's go back to the genesis of what the government has done, and in terms of keeping files on its citizens, particularly in the post-9/11 era. Shortly after 9/11, there was quite a flap over Admiral Poindexter's proposal, the Total Information Awareness Database, that had sort of ubiquitous trolling of information, that was shot down. So how much is this the nose of the camel of total information awareness?
You know, total information awareness was this idea, actually. It was never put in action, that Admiral Poindexter had after 9/11. And his concept, which was really just a concept, was to get all data, credit card transactions, commercial data from around the country, and match it with all the government's data about citizens, airline trips, et cetera, and put them all in one giant database, which, you know, the idea was if you knew basically every single data point about every citizen, you would be able to find the terrorists. And he ran into a huge amount of trouble. You know, Congress defunded the program. He had to retire. And it was roundly criticized. Now, the program now, the National Counterterrorism Center, is not as broad in the sense that they're only talking about government data. They're not talking about all the commercial data, credit card transactions, and all your relationships with internet services, and et cetera. However, it does actually talk about every single bit of data you have within the government. Theoretically, under these new rules, the Counterterrorism Center does have access to all of those, all the data in the government that is about you. So it is a piece of what was envisioned in TIA, but not the whole piece.
So tell us about, Julia Angwin, the TIDE database that the Counterterrorism Center has already. It's got, 500,000, the National Counterterrorism Center, I should say. It has, 500,000 entries or identities?
That's the estimate. They're not disclosing, but I think the last time that there was a number disclosed to Congress, it was about 500,000 people on the watch list, this TIDE watch list. The TIDE list is a list of people who are either suspected terrorists or friends of terrorists or possibly just related to terrorists in a loose way. And so it's a list of people basically that the Counterterrorism Center wants to keep an eye on. Now, that list is actually what the FBI uses to create the real watch list, which is a much smaller list, and that's what sort of contributes to the no-fly list. So those are people with whom they actually have very strong suspicion. So it's a much smaller set. So basically, the way you get on a watch list is first you get into this TIDE, this larger watch list of sort of people with suspicious friends or suspicious behavior, and then if there's enough of a reason, you end up on this like very specific watch list that can prohibit certain types of activities.
But that's been proven to be inaccurate, has it not? I recall Senator Edward Kennedy, the late Senator Kennedy, was stopped, prevented from getting on a plane, and there have been some somewhat comical examples, have there not?
There have. I mean, the problem with the watch list is it's gone, you know, I think right after 9/11, it got very restrictive, and there were a lot of absurd examples, like, you know, the Senator Kennedy example of people being prohibited from flying. Then they tried to loosen it up, and then, of course, you know, you had the underwear bomber who probably should have been on it. So it's a constant struggle to get these watch lists correct. You know, and there's a lot of evidence that we see of the incorrect moments. Of course, the people in the intelligence community will tell you, oh, but you don't see the success stories. Those are the ones that you never hear about. And, you know, we have to sort of take that on faith.
So tell us then, Julia Angwin, about how this new National Counterterrorism Center list is going to operate. It apparently can keep data about innocent U.S. citizens for up to 5 years using predictive pattern matching to analyze suspicious patterns of behavior.
Right. So as I mentioned before, the previous way that people were, you know, analyzed at the center were that some tip had come in. So, you know, underwear bomber's dad says my son is a terrorist. You know, that would be enough of a tip to then have them go pull the files. Now, the way they have the authority to basically run patterns through the database. So let's say they get an entire database from everybody who's ever flown to a certain country, and they decide that everyone on there might be possibly a terrorist if they meet certain conditions, meaning they wore pink that day and they had frizzy hair. I'm making this up, but my point is they could come up with some patterns, and they've gotten the authority to run those types of patterns on these large data sets and then investigate whether those people are terrorists. And this really just changes the equation, because previously you as a citizen or me as a citizen had this feeling that, you know, I'm probably not going to end up in their crosshairs because I'm not a terrorist and I'm not friends with any terrorists. But now there's this element of thinking, wow, you know, and you don't know what the criteria is, and you could be sort of caught in this dragnet at any time.
And apparently these databases can be shared with foreign governments. Lists and data on U.S. civilians can be handed over to foreign governments for analysis.
Yeah, this is one of the more amazing things of the new guidelines. So the authority that they got under the new guidelines that were issued in March actually does allow these databases to be shared in their entirety with foreign governments. Obviously, you know, people in the intelligence community say, look, we're not going to do that willy-nilly, and it would be under certain conditions. But the fact is that they do have an incredible authority there to share this data, so it explicitly says to help them analyze it for clues about terrorism. So not only would, theoretically, the National Counterterrorism Center be looking for people flying to a certain country with pink frizzy hair, but also other governments could add their own criteria, in theory.
So again, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Wall Street Journal, Julia Angwin, who has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. Tell us about the dissent within the government, particularly at Homeland Security. And it would seem that the main dissenters lost the battle. There's no question about that. But they also left government, did they not?
Yeah, although I would say that the dissenters, it seems from my reporting, left government in a planned way. They were, you know, the change of, you know, most people kind of do one term of service and maybe they were coming to the end of it. However, it is true that the department, there were two people at the Department of Homeland Security, the head of the privacy office there and the head of the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, who were very concerned about this change. And there was also somebody at the Department of Justice, the chief privacy officer there, who raised concerns. And they were, you know, they did lose the fight, although some people would say that they probably softened some of it or got some concessions in this new guidelines. But the fact is that I think it's kind of telling that the Department of Homeland Security, these are the privacy officers there, is the ones who approved full body scanners, right? So these are not people who are on the far left of the privacy fight, right? They're fully okay with taking pictures of us nude. But even they thought that this went too far. And to me, that was kind of a compelling argument why it was worth writing about, because it seemed to me that even people who were very much committed to the terrorism fight were saying, look, this crosses a line that we shouldn't be crossing.
Well, it seems, I mean, one of the quotes in your article, Julia Angwin, one of your sources is a senior administration official familiar with the White House debate saying that this program is breathtaking in its scope. Now, I recall in the Bush administration, there was an incident when the attorney general was in a hospital and was very ill, and he had transferred his powers to the deputy attorney general, who had raced to the hospital room along with the head of the FBI to stop the White House chief of staff and White House counsel, Gonzalez, from getting the attorney general to renew a surveillance regime, as far as we know, that the head of the FBI and the deputy attorney general wanted to stop. And they thought that they were doing this in a kind of underhand and stealth way. So we've never found out what that regime was that those two senior officials went to such lengths to stop.
Mm-hmm. That story is still, we're still waiting to hear the end of that, right? I mean, everybody has heard this dramatic story, but we're still waiting to find out what was the scope of that program that was, you know, described as wireless wiretapping, exactly how many of our conversations and emails were being wiretapped.
So just give us a sense then, Julia, of how this extra government surveillance is happening in the context of the broader issue. You mentioned commercial data mining. It's pretty ubiquitous, isn't it? I mean, I noticed, you know, Google seems to know a lot about you, keeps recommending stuff all the time. And we, the younger generation on Facebook, and of course, you've clearly written about this in your articles at the Wall Street Journal, what they know. The younger generation seem to be quite happy to post all kinds of details about their private lives. So privacy itself seems to be under assault, both in the commercial realm and in the government realm. Are those two engines likely to get together? Or perhaps they have.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that a lot of people think of government surveillance and commercial surveillance as separate, but in fact, they're very much related. So one, and the main reason that they're related is because of our outdated laws governing privacy. So the Fourth Amendment is really the amendment that, of the Constitution that is most concerned with privacy in the sense that it says you can't have a search of somebody's home or their person's papers or effects without probable cause. And that has been sort of the standard bearer for privacy in the sense of limiting government intrusion on our lives without cause. The problem is that the courts have interpreted the Fourth Amendment to basically not cover anything not stored in your house. And these days, our digital lives are stored all over the place, right? Our data is stored with Google or with Facebook, and the government has a lot of data about us, and so it's not in our house. And the law still sort of takes a very physical approach to search. So it protects information in your house, but not the information that's in the government files or in Google's files. And so that means that basically the government doesn't have to show probable cause when it's searching your email, right? Or in your cell phone location records. We've written a lot about both of those cases where there's a lot of people who feel like this isn't a fair rule and it should be updated. In fact, most of the tech companies, Google, Apple, have joined a coalition asking for those laws to be updated. But so we're in a legal regime that just hasn't caught up with the technology, and that means that a lot of our data is up for grabs, not just the government data or just the commercial data, but all of it.
Well, just in closing, Julia Angwin, who has the upper hand here? I'm reminded of one of the founding fathers, Ben Frankman's admonition that he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. In terms of the array of, and your article makes it pretty clear that those on the privacy side lost this bureaucratic battle in the White House. But those on the other side, of course, John Brennan is now nominated to be head of the CIA. Eric Holder is leaving Justice, but I'm not sure that he was ever that zealous in that in terms of protecting privacy. How would you see the array of pro and con privacy in the administration? And after all, it was the president himself who apparently demanded that the government clean up its database after the aborted underwear bomber.
Well, the thing is that privacy is one of those things that's very difficult for politicians to be for. I mean, they can be for it in the abstract, but when you are, it's so easy to say, I want to be tough on terrorism. That's a winning strategy, right? And so it's the so far, all of these battles, the Patriot Act, the warrantless wiretapping, you know, all of these battles have been lost by the privacy people because they can't show dead bodies on the ground. And, you know, that may be the right solution. Maybe we don't care as much about privacy as a society as we do about terrorism. But I think that what's happening is as people become more aware of what's happening, privacy is becoming a more important topic. You can certainly see it in sort of popular culture. People talk about it more. People change their Facebook setting, privacy settings more than they ever did before. So I think that there may be a changing public sentiment, but it has not yet reached the government. That tide of change has not yet reached the government enough that they want to do anything to change their behavior.
So what are we left with? The public getting sufficiently outraged?
I think so. I mean, it's actually, if you don't mind me promoting, I'm writing a book right now on this exact question, which is it possible to really promote, to do anything to protect your privacy, you individually, or does it require is it beyond the scope of any sort of individual? And so I've been doing a lot of things to try to protect my privacy, and I'm finding it's extremely difficult, and it's basically a full-time job. But I'm hoping that readers will learn from my experience that it's not just, quote, their fault for having given up their data to Google or Facebook, but that it's actually really, really hard in our current environment to protect your privacy on your own, and possibly we need a little more collective action.
Well, I look forward to your book, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Julia Angwin, who's an award-winning investigative journalist at The Wall Street Journal. She's the author of Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. In 2003, she was on a team of reporters at The Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for coverage of corporate corruption. And in 2010, she led a team of reporters that chronicled the decline of online privacy in a series of articles titled What They Know, that won the Gerald Loeb Award. She has an article in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, U.S. Terrorism Agency to Tap a Vast Database of Citizens. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the brazen Republican efforts at gerrymandering in the Virginia legislature.
I'm looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65.
Good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Keisha Gaskins, who is a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and senior counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. She has spent much of her career advocating for the rights of underserved populations, especially with regard to voting rights and democratic reform. From 2007 until 2011, she was executive director of the League of Women Voters in Minnesota, which succeeded in registering over 10,000 new voters during her tenure. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keisha Gaskins.
Thank you.
And the Virginia legislature, at least the Virginia Senate, managed to push through a bill where they basically, there are 20 seats each between the Democrats and the Republicans, a 2020 standoff. But one of the Democratic state senators had to go to the presidential inauguration. So they managed to push through this bill one by one vote to have a radical redistricting of the state of Virginia, which is undoubtedly a key swing state. So that sort of got my attention, Keisha, because so many of the redistricting that's taken place in the last few years has taken place in key swing states. So is there a pattern here?
Well, I mean, redistricting takes place in literally thousands of jurisdictions around the country, and it's mandated. It's mandated, of course, following the census to make sure that all electoral districts have equal population under the Constitution. What you're seeing, and I think what you're sensing from the redistricting process, is that because in most states, 37 states to be exact, we leave redistricting up to partisan legislatures. And in most cases, partisan legislatures tend to act in take advantage of partisanship and try and leverage the redistricting process to best advantage their party. And so we're seeing, you know, as we're seeing simultaneously fewer and fewer divided houses and divided states where there is required to be a compromise, you're seeing single-party legislatures having control over the redistricting process. And this last time, we saw that Republicans, in fact, had control over four times as many districts as Democrats in drawing district lines. But certainly in both cases where we saw single-party control over the redistricting process, we saw single-party benefit in the redistricting process.
So, but this has happened recently in the key states of Pennsylvania, in Ohio, and in Wisconsin as well, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly we saw, because we saw single-party control in the states you identified, as well as states like Illinois, North Carolina, Maryland, we saw partisan actors really taking advantage of their control in the Senate and or in the legislature. So you saw states like Wisconsin, where they actually changed the law and accelerated the redistricting process in order to avoid the risk that they would lose partisan control in the 2011 special election. So you did see absolutely extraordinary behavior like you saw yesterday in the Virginia Senate.
So, again, I'm speaking with Keisha Gaskins, a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and senior counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. The of course, we don't know what's going to happen in Virginia. The governor says he was caught by surprise, but he's non-committal on the new maps. But there's no question. My understanding, the statistics are pretty clear from the last election that we just had, that a lot more Americans voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives than they did for Republicans, and yet the Republicans have a substantial majority.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that goes back to really the 2010 electoral victories in the states, where we saw somewhere north of 670 new Republicans take a hold of seats in states across the country. And that control really led to, as I said, four times as many Republican districts controlling, four times as many states where Republicans controlled the line drawing than Democrats. And so you saw this kind of disproportionality in terms of the outcomes, because these states were able to draw like relatively disproportionate lines in a state like, for example, North Carolina, that without a significant change in the electorate went from a seven Republicans and six Democrats to 10 Republicans and three Democratic seats. And so it's those types of that type of disproportionality that becomes part of the process when we allow redistricting to be controlled by partisans.
And of course, in the case that just took place yesterday in Virginia, the sort of stealth change, while one of the key Democrats was at the inauguration, in defending what they did, the sponsor of the bill, Republican Senator John Watkins of Powhatan, defended it as an effort to create another majority black Senate district. But what he didn't say is it would create many more GOP-dominated districts. So,
Yeah, I think that that's a result of what is called packing. That when you tend to pack, African Americans in particular tend to skew Democratic, and so when you pack a bunch of Democrats into a single district, that of course leaves more capacity to create Republican districts around it. Slate.com. Certainly came out and said, look, the early analysis is telling us that right now we have a 20-20 split, and the new lines proposed by the Senate looks like coming out close to 13 Democratic districts and 27 Republican districts. So, I mean, we are seeing some significant changes over the current lines, and we will see. I mean, certainly Bob McDonnell said he was surprised. He condemned the action of the Senate, but did not go so far as to say he would absolutely veto.
Well, you know, in yesterday's coverage of the inauguration on MSNBC, Chris Matthews made a statement which got a lot of attention, where he said that he felt that the Republicans, in order to overcome the growing deficit they have in demographics, where more and more young and minorities and women are voting Democrat, that they will make up for it by simply gerrymandering and rigging the vote. I mean, this is beginning to look like maybe Chris Matthews has a point.
You know, I think that Chris Matthews' point is well taken, that when we're talking about the disproportionality, that GOP really have been very effective in leveraging partisan gerrymandering or partisan favored line drawing to compensate for the imbalance between the votes that the Democrats are getting right now over the Republicans.
So, what then if the Democrats don't wake up? I don't know what can they do. Do the same thing? I mean, both sides have been.
I think the challenge is these lines are in place for the next 10 years. I don't know if the Democrats can kind of wake up and fix it. Certainly, the Cook Political Report came out and said the Democrats might need to win 55% of all House votes cast in order to win a majority at any point in the next decade. Okay.
So that's how far behind they are in terms of...
That's how far behind. And to tell you how frequently that's happened, in the 13 of the last 15 cycles, neither party has hit 55% of the vote. So it is, I mean, the way the lines are drawn has presented a seriously heavy lift for the Democrats to overcome the way these lines have been drawn. And it's really, you know, to suggest that Democrats need to wake up and sort of fault of Democrats, it's actually the fault of how we've allowed lines to be drawn. Certainly over time, Democrats have benefited when Democrats have been in control. Now the Republicans are in control and they're benefiting from these lines. And we saw when the Democrats were in control in the 80s, we saw some similar types of things it was in 1990, where Republicans won 46% of the popular vote, but only 38% of the House seats. So this behavior isn't particularly new. What we are seeing, however, that is particularly new is the disproportionality of it, how big the gaps are, how difficult those gaps are overcome over time.
So, in other words, even if the Democrats had a Karl Rove who had that kind of strategic vision to go after these...
Karl Rove's vision and a whole lot of money didn't buy him a lot last time.
But over the last 10 years the last
absolutely.
Few years, they've done incredibly well, and they put it in place
absolutely.
For 10 years. So that's a big hill to climb for the Democrats.
Right.
I mean, my understanding is there is at least an example of an alternative to this crooked partisan game playing that's been going on forever in terms of districting. That's what we have now in California.
There's a number of alternatives that seem to be working. You certainly have what we saw in what you all have in California with the nonpartisan commission, and that something similar to Arizona and other places where they have the commission. If you look at Florida, it's also a really good example. You had complete Republican control over both houses and the governorship. They had two new congressional seats, but because Florida's electorate had made a constitutional amendment to change how what criteria by which they controlled the legislative redistricting, none of those new districts were under Republican control. They actually had created a new minority population district and a new Democratic district, and that was simply the legislature still did it, but it was because of the way they changed the criteria. So that's another example of how redistricting can be done without necessarily, and leave it in the hands of the legislature, but not necessarily result in these same kinds of outcomes. There certainly are other plans that are advocated that are a lot more radical, that involve getting rid of redistricting altogether, going to multi-member districts, changing the way we think about how people are represented. But certainly under our existing rubrics, looking at single-member districts, independent commissions are an option. Changing how we look at the redistricting cycles are an option. Some would advocate for changing the timing of redistricting. And so there's all kinds of different options out there, but certainly the most recent and obvious examples are those like in California, Arizona, and Florida.
Well, just in closing then, Keisha Gaskins, hasn't this, though, this redistricting and this gerrymandering by dividing these congressional seats up in such a way that they look like some weird amoeba, and there's no coherence to them except they're sort of skirting different demographic blocks. And you were mentioning earlier, you know, a heavily African-American district is considered Democrat. And what's this obviously leading to is a lot of safe seats on both sides, where you have far more partisan representation because they're safe, and they don't have to, unlike their colleagues in the Senate who represent the whole state, they don't have to moderate their views.
And that's certainly that's certainly a concern. There are. You know, while I don't want to put too much of a benefit on simply having uniform districts, I know there's an idea that says districts should be circular, they should be square. But in fact, we don't live in perfect circles. We don't live in perfect squares. How district lines are drawn can be responding to any number of things, not just partisan pressures. But there is a very serious concern concern that where partisans are able to draw lines in a way that disproportionately allow them to gain and keep control over the legislature is where we also see opportunities for really bad and non-representative legislative action. And, you know, I don't know that the answer is necessarily safe seats or not safe seats, but we do know that part of the answer is making sure the seats are actually representative of how people live, how people vote. And what we're seeing is disproportionality based on and drawing lines in a very, shall we say, creative way to ensure partisan victories.
Well, something's rotten in the state of Denmark if we have Absolutely. Less turnover in the U.S. Congress than they used to have in the Supreme Soviet, of the rubber stamp parliament of the former Soviet Union. So,
and I think,
fact.
These are all political issues that sort of play against each other. But right. at the end of the day, drawing districts in a way that don't represent the electorate, that that protect parties and incumbents and while not doing a good job in representing people is a very serious problem.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Keisha Gaskins.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Keisha Gaskins, who's a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and senior counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program. She spent much of her career advocating for the rights of underserved populations, especially with regard to voting rights and democratic reform. From 2007 until 2011, she was executive director of the League of Women Voters in Minnesota, where she succeeded in registering over 10,000 new voters during her tenure. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how long the cover-up within the Catholic Church, particularly here in the largest diocese of Los Angeles, has gone on, and recent revelations of how much Cardinal Mahoney was responsible for covering up abusive priests.
Behind the scenes, they grow their schemes, hiding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joelle Castex, who is the West Coast spokesperson for SNAP, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests, a former journalist, educator, and public relations professional. She's now a leading national spokesperson, writer, public speaker, and advocate for victims of child sex abuse. Her blog, The Worthy Adversary, has become one of the most popular and well-read online journals chronicling issues of child sexual abuse. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joelle Castex.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Los Angeles Times on Tuesday is running a front page story. LA church leaders sought to hide sex abuse cases from authorities, which reveals documents from the late 1980s that show Archbishop Roger Mahoney and other archdiocese officials discussed strategies to keep police from discovering that children were being sexually abused by priests. Now, for the longest time, the country's largest archdiocese, Los Angeles, has fought to keep this evidence from ever keep it secret. And it seems to have come out in a civil case, even though the LA district attorney tried to look into it. And so did the United States attorney here in Los Angeles.
That's true. And the Archdiocese, you know, they had promised documents as a part of the 2007 settlement with 500 victims of sex abuse. But these documents were not a part of that settlement. They're part of a new lawsuit against a priest named Nicholas Aguilar Rivera. And because of a tenacious attorney named Anthony DeMarco, he was able to get these documents and make them public.
And these are documents that pretty much reveal the role of Cardinal Mahony in being the arbiter of the fate of these priests. And some of it is actually quite incriminating.
Exactly. I mean, this is the first time that we have had real proof how hands-on Cardinal Mahony was in the career management of these perpetrator pedophile priests. And it's shocking because for years, you know, we knew that he was involved. We knew that other church officials like Monsignor Curry were involved. But we had no idea how meticulously they worked to ensure that men that they knew were a risk and were abusing kids, that they had a complete strategy to make sure that those men were never sent to jail and that victims were never informed that they had rights.
Well, instead of sending these men to jail, apparently they sent them off to a retreat in New Mexico, where they apparently, it was called the Servants of the Paraclete. And while some of these pedophile priests were in this retreat, presumably to cure them of pedophilia, the Archbishop Mahony wrote to one of the priests, a particularly egregious one, who had raped young boys and abused a whole lot of young children in the Catholic Church, and this is Garcia, and Mahony writes to Garcia and says, "Each of you there at Yemeni Springs, this is this retreat, is very much in my prayers, and I call you to mind each day during my celebration of the Eucharist." I've heard this before, and it's been pretty evident before, that one of the strangest things about the Catholic hierarchy is they seem to be bending over backwards to protect the perpetrators and ignore the victims. And again, the evidence here is overwhelming.
Exactly. I mean, the Servants of the Paraclete in New Mexico was the biggest treatment center for offending clerics in the United States for a long period of time. Men who were sent there for one reason, and that's because they were molesting kids. And so Cardinal Mahony was reserving all of his prayers for these child molesters while not lifting a finger to help the victims, not calling law enforcement, not informing parents, not doing anything. And then when many of these men came back, they were allowed right back into ministry where they continued to offend.
Well, this particular priest, Garcia, who apparently tied up and raped a young boy in Lancaster, another priest, Father Arturo Gomez, who was an associate pastor at a predominantly Spanish-speaking church, he wrote to his regional bishop in 1989 saying that he was angry and disappointed. I'm reading here from the story in the Los Angeles Times, who, by the way, have to be commended because they were a part of a lawsuit that prevented the church from redacting the names of all these priests in these documents. Otherwise, we wouldn't even know who we're talking about here. He was disappointed in the church's failure to help Garcia's victims, and he expressed shock that the bishop Juan A. Azubi had told the family of two of the boys that Garcia had thought of taking his own life, which prompted Gomez to write to the bishop, "You seem to be at the moment more concerned for the criminal rather than the victim."
Exactly. And it's, you know, and to make it clear, these documents, the redactions you were talking about and the wonderful intervention that the LA Times did was actually about a different set of documents. And those are the ones that are about the settlement that the Archdiocese had with the 500 victims of sexual abuse in 2007. These documents are a different case. So even if the redactions in the other cases had been forced to go through, we would have been able to see these documents redacted the way that they should have been, which is only the victims' names and innocent third parties would have been redacted. So, but as you can see, I mean, these every case that the Times covered in the story, it's shocking, the crimes of these priests. And there are guys who, like Michael Wimpey and Michael Baker, who have served prison sentences for what they did 20 years after Cardinal Mahony knew of their crimes. There's Tamayo, who was a Philippine priest, and he and six other Philippine priests raped a young Los Angeles woman and impregnated her. And when she came forward, the archdiocese fought her case tooth and nail. But what we find out in the documents is that as the archdiocese was fighting this brave victim, they knew all along that Tamayo had done it, and they knew all along that the other priests had done it. And what does this say about the pastoral attitude of the diocese? What does this say about the moral authority that Cardinal Mahony or Monsignor, now Bishop Curry, have? It basically says that these men are morally bankrupt, and all they cared about was their pocketbook and their reputation. And I really believe, and hopefully law enforcement will be able to find good enough evidence, that Mahony and Curry should be held responsible, fully responsible, to the law for what they did.
Again, I'm speaking with Joelle Castex, who's the West Coast spokesperson for SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by a Priest, and she also has a blog, The Worthy Adversary, which has become one of the most popular and well-read online journals chronicling issues of child sexual abuse. And I don't mean to dwell on this Monsignor Peter Garcia, who preyed on for decades on undocumented children in predominantly Spanish-speaking parishes. And he, of course, went to this New Mexico treatment center that we were talking about. In one case, apparently, according to the church documents, he threatened to have a boy he raped deported if he went to the police. So again, this is the worst abuse of authority in the sense that these people are acting as though they're above the law, and for the longest time they have been above the law, and I'm amazed that the U.S. attorney couldn't crack this case. Steve Cooley, the Los Angeles District Attorney, couldn't crack this case, but now it's starting to come open as a result of a civil case.
Yeah, because they couldn't get the access to these documents that they needed, and the Garcia case is very important for another reason, because it highlights what survivors have been saying for the longest time, is that the newest cases that are coming forward, we're finding that the archdiocese and many other dioceses around the country would dump predator priests in parishes that were predominantly Spanish-speaking, predominantly poor, and were populated with a lot of undocumented immigrant families, because those are children who do not report. They don't report for cultural reasons. They don't report for language reasons. They don't report for money reasons, and they don't report because they're scared that they're going to be deported. And Cardinal Mahony knew this, and for years he held himself up as a champion on immigration rights. But what we have found, that while out of one side of his mouth he was saying he was a champion for immigration rights, on the other side he was dumping his worst priests in Spanish-speaking neighborhoods and putting these poor, innocent, vulnerable children in the path of monsters, and he did nothing to stop it, and he didn't care.
And Joelle Castex, he was in communication, was he not, with Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now the Pope, who was then, I can't remember the exact title that he had, but he was the sort of in charge of the doctrine of the faith or something.
Yeah, the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith.
Right, right. So what do you know about those exchanges that had to do with pedophile priests?
What canon law required of the archdiocese and every diocese around the world is that when they get a report of abuse, they must keep a file of all those documents, which are these files that we see. And they must make a report to Rome, because in many cases, it's up to Rome to decide whether or not they're going to have what they call a canonical trial, which is just an internal, disciplinary hearing that has no standing whatsoever with civil authorities, and of course, is certainly not shared with civil authorities. So in Rome, are files just as extensive, if not more extensive, than what the Archdiocese has about all of the predator priests who lived and worked here in Los Angeles and molested kids here. So Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict, had a full and thorough knowledge of the abuse that was going on here, and Cardinal Mahoney, supplied them with that information. Yet he did not call the police in some of these most egregious cases.
So in other words, Rome is sitting on all this information. The Vatican has all this information to this day.
And, exactly.
And but it still appears to be that the priority seems to be that they can, either if they can't cover up, they can pay off.
Yes. And it, for them, it's much easier to pay off a silent case because they are doing, they do the best they can, and it's outlined in the documents to avoid what they call civil liability. And that means that, crime victims have civil rights. And they have civil rights because in many ways, it is only through our civil justice system that we are really able to punish wrongdoers for crimes past certain statutes of limitations. And it's one of the few ways that we can make victims whole. And, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, with Cardinal Mahoney and Monsignor, now Bishop Curry, obviously did everything they could to make sure that victims had no rights and perpetrators had all the rights.
Well, Joelle, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it has been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joelle Castex, who is the West Coast spokesperson for SNAP, the Survivors Network for Those Abused by Priests. She's a former journalist, educator, and public relations professional, and she's now a leading national spokesperson, writer, public speaker, and advocate for victims of child sex abuse. Her blog, The Worthy Adversary, has become one of the most popular and well-read online journals chronicling issues of child sexual abuse. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And you can also contact us at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now. Down in America, the guy that lived next door in 305.